Should we tell her who you are?
You trust her?
Yes. Then go ahead.
Tanyel shrugged, dropping the whisper. Your men already know. Word will get out eventually that I'm still alive.
All right, Vlora spoke up. Little Flaring, this is Tanyel Two-Shot.
Flaring scoffed.
No shitting.
No shitting, Tanyel said, offering his hand.
Vlora continued. Tanyel, this is Little Flaring. She makes powder. She sold the Adran army enough gunpowder to get us through the Kez Civil War. And then some. Flaring took Tanyel's hand.
Two damn powder mages out here on the frontier. Adran powder mages. And one of you's supposed to be dead. What are you doing here?
Tanyel whispered softly.
You're sure you trust her?
I do, Vlora responded. She's an Adran hero after the Kez Civil War, and we work together closely.
You'd better trust her,
Tanyel said, still in a whisper.
Because it's here.
The stone?
Yes.
I sensed it moments after we split up. I've been trying to find you to tell you. It's definitely here. But I don't know where. We might need help finding it.
Vlora had no idea why Tanyel could sense the thing, and she could not. It probably had something to do with Carpole's sorcery. But confirming it was actually here was the first step in their mission.
Flaring, she said, do you have somewhere we could talk?
Chapter 19. Mikkel spent nearly a week following Marhoosh before finally losing patience. He and Tenek sat on the rooftop of an abandoned store about a block from the cobblers, where their target had been holed up this entire time. It was a blisteringly hot afternoon, the roofing tar sticking to the bottom of their shoes, but Mikkel wanted the vantage point to be able to see down into the street, both in front of and behind Marhoosh's hiding spot. He sat near the edge of the flat roof, hidden behind a cluster of chimney stacks, and watched the street while he and Tenek sweltered. A week, he knew, was a long time. There had been two other bombings. A perpetrator had been caught after the second, but she'd managed to commit suicide before being questioned. Mikkel had recognized the body as that of a bronze rose who worked for Jatura. Beyond that one lead, none of Yaret's household had managed to get any closer to tracking down the source of the bombings.
Marhoosh hasn't come outside for over a day, Tenek observed.
The Dainai's had his feet up, his shirt off, and wrapped around his head to shade it from the sun.
He might have a secret entrance,
Mikkel responded. He spent the first 2 days scouring the area and consulting old maps to find out if that were the case. The basement of the cobbler's shop might connect with the catacombs within the plateau, but he didn't think they did. More likely, Marhoosh had slipped out sometime the night before last when Mikkel was catching a little sleep and just hadn't come back. He'd left one of Yaret's household layabouts to keep watch, but didn't know if they were at all reliable. Mikkel would soon find out. He consulted his pocket watch, then glanced down the street, where he saw a squad of Dainai soldiers milling about in the intersection. They took their helmets off, exchanged skins of tea, and spoke freely among themselves. A similar scene was playing out in two other nearby intersections, and Mikkel couldn't help but smile. In the short time he'd been among the Dainai's, he'd found out a great many things. One was that Yaret's household had access to hundreds, perhaps thousands, of loyal soldiers that could be called upon in a pinch. Another thing he'd learned was that the Dainai soldiers took orders very well. Give them a battle plan, and they'd follow it. Explain how to properly stage a raid, and they'd follow your instructions to the letter.
What happens if we don't catch the Silver Rose?
Tennick asked. He took out his coin for the first time in 2 days and flipped it, caught it, then flipped it again.
Depends on the size of the safe house and the number of black hats we pull out of it. If we catch even 2 of them, we'll be able to start asking questions. They might put us back on Mahusha's track, or even help us find the gold rose.
He didn't bother adding, if we're lucky. He was incredibly frustrated that Mahush had slipped past him, and if this raid came up with nothing useful, he'd be out a week's worth of work, which wouldn't inspire confidence in his new boss.
Tennick lifted his hands, ticking off fingers as he spoke. Iron, roses are the lowest rung. Then bronze, brass, silver, and gold?
That's right.
And you were a gold rose?
Only briefly. I earned me gold rose just before the invasion by tracking down a payload freedom fighter. I was a silver rose for a couple of years.
This Mahush, how well do you know him?
Only by sight. We've met twice, I think.
You have a good memory?
When you're a spy, you have to develop a talent for names and faces. It'll save your life.
And how well do you know the gold rose he works for?
Shatura?
Mikhail thought for a moment, picturing Shatura in his mind.
I saw him at the millinery once. He's a mean, stocky little bastard. Shorter than you and twice as wide. Carries a broadsword around with him.
Tennick snorted.
Does he use it?
Often, from what I've heard. Chops off the hands of people who anger him, the feet of people who betray him, and the heads of his enemies.
And you people call us savages.
Tennick tilted his head to get a view of the street before getting comfortable once more.
There are always rumours about powerful people. Are any of them true?
I'm not sure. I didn't believe half the rumours about Fidelis Jess until I began to work directly under him.
I've heard of this Fidelis Jess,
Tennick said.
He was one of the people our informants told us to be wary of as we tried to take the city. Was he a good master?
Mikhail considered the threats and the morning duels.
I believe he was good at his job.
That is not the same as being a good master.
He was an asshole, and I'm not sad that Ben Stike cut his head off.
Tennick grinned broadly.
That is the answer I was looking for. You will find Yarrett a much better master than that. When he dies, I'll grieve as much as any of his family.
Tennick had referenced Yarrett as a good person, or a considerate master, on several occasions throughout the last week. Mikhail hadn't spent any time with him since that first day, so he didn't have a point of reference, but he doubted that Yarrett could live up to the hype. Mikhail had worked under decent people and even competent roses, but in his experience, the higher up the chain of command, the less room there was for basic humanity. Mikhail kept facing the street, but watched Tennick out of the corner of his eye. He'd come to rather like the man over the course of the week. Tennick was a wealth of knowledge about his people, but seemed just as interested in learning about Fatrasta and the Nine as Mikhail was about the Dianais. He rarely turned Mikhail away from a question, and had a quiet sense of humour that belied his sharp eyes and ability to grasp a concept or situation easily. He was also, Mikhail had found, oddly naive in certain ways. The situation between the Palo and the Cressians was one of those. As if he could hear Mikhail's thoughts, Tennick suddenly said, "Are the Palo always treated like that?" Mikhail glanced over to see Tennick watching the street. He followed Tenick's gaze down to a Cressian man openly beating a Palo labourer about the shoulders with his cane, only retreating when one of the Dianai soldiers seemed to take interest in the altercation.
"Yes," Mikhail said, returning to his examination of the cobbler's shop.
The Dianai soldiers, relaxing at the various intersections, began to put their helmets back on, saying goodbyes as if they'd finished a quiet afternoon break.
"You're Palo, aren't you?"
"But," Mikhail responded. He leaned forward, watching as the soldiers fixed their bayonets and shouldered their weapons, then began to walk swiftly towards the cobbler's shop. The counterparts on three different intersections began to do the same, forming a pincer movement that would cut off all four possible avenues of escape from the safe house. Tenick didn't seem to notice that the raid was going forward.
"If you're half Palo, and the Cressians treat the Palo so poorly, why do you fight for them?"
Mikhail had no interest in explaining the ulterior motives he had for joining the Black Hats and climbing their ranks. For one, it would raise too many questions. For another, well, the whole situation was a sore point, to say the least. He wondered briefly where Taniel's people had hidden his mother, and hoped she was well out of harm's way.
"Because," Mikhail answered glibly, "I can still take advantage of being half Cressian to live a better life."
He directed Tenick's attention to the raid.
"Here we go."
Dianai's soldiers flooded the cobbler's shop, the alley next to it, and the buildings on either side. They cut off every possible exit and kicked in the doors, rushing inside with bayonets ready. The raid was a complete surprise. Mikhail could tell from the lack of gunfire and the surprised look of the roses as they were dragged into the street and held at musket point. Mikhail examined each as they were brought out, praying that Mahoosh would be one of the faces. He wasn't. 13 in total were pulled from the cobbler's shop. Mikhail guessed that only 7 of those were actual roses, the rest sympathizers. A small crowd of onlookers began to assemble. The soldiers ignored them, dragging off their captives, and the traffic soon returned to normal. Mikhail waited for about 5 minutes before he signalled to Tenick.
"Let's go and see what kind of a catch we got."
The captives had been taken to an abandoned warehouse about half a mile away. Mikhail and Tenick joined the captain of the soldiers just outside.
"We found roses on 4 of them," the captain said, dropping the medallions into Tenick's outstretched hand.
There were 3 irons and a bronze. 2 others seemed to be black hats as well. The rest claim ignorance.
"The cobbler?" Mikhail asked.
"He says he had no idea black hats were hiding in his attic."
The captain did not sound convinced.
"Did they tell you where Mahoosh is?" Mikhail asked.
She shook her head.
"The lot claim to have never heard the name."
"Let me see them."
Mikhail entered the warehouse through a side door and climbed up to an iron catwalk that crossed above the middle of the large, dusty space. He proceeded to a spot just above the group of prisoners. They sat on the dirt floor, hands tied, heads down, with a group of soldiers keeping watch. Mikhail leaned on the catwalk railing and examined them for several minutes.
"That one," he finally said in a quiet voice, pointing to a woman whose lip bled from being smacked around by a soldier. "She's a bronze rose. She used to be a silver rose. A year ago she was caught taking protection money from a family who had personal ties to Lindit. She was demoted."
Tenick frowned at the information.
"What does that mean?"
"It means she's a greedy little piggy," Mikhail responded. "Bring her."
Tenick nodded to the captain. He and Mikhail headed into one of the second-floor offices on the opposite side of the warehouse, where Mikhail paced while he waited. Tenick leaned comfortably in the corner, flipping his coin, obviously pleased to be out of the heat.
You're going to try to turn her?
I am.
For over a month, we've been offering rewards for anyone who will turn. Why would she do so now?
People don't give up when they think they have options. Our dear Bronze Rose is down to just two, and I'm going to make sure she knows it.
Their conversation was interrupted by the door opening and a soldier coming in with the Bronze Rose, whom he pushed to her knees in the middle of the floor. Her eyes went first to Tenik, then to Mikkel. She seemed confused to find a Palo and a Mutt rather than a Dionysus torture squad.
Mikkel smiled at her gently, trying to recall her name.
Soriana, was it?
He asked.
How do you know my name?
Because I used to be a Black Hat.
The information took a moment to process before her eyes widened.
You're him, aren't you? Mikkel. How the pit did you find us already?
Because Lindit left a bunch of thugs behind rather than spies.
You're a damn traitor.
She wasn't wrong.
Mikkel kept his smile and tutted. Let's not be so judgmental this early on, shall we?
Soriana looked around the room, her eyes lingering on the Dainai soldiers standing by the door. Mikkel could see the same thoughts ticking through her head that had gone through his own in a few tight situations.
How well tied are my bonds? How closely are they watching? Can I fight or talk my way out of this?
He didn't give her a chance to consider those options.
Sorry, Anna. Do you know where I can find either Mahush or Jertura?
He asked. She drew herself up, as best she could while kneeling with hands tied behind her back.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Mikkel rolled his eyes.
Oh, let's have a quick rundown of your options, sorry, Anna. If you'd like, you can play the good little Black Hat. If you do that, I'll be forced to hand you over to the fine gentleman outside, who will torture you for every scrap of information, and then execute you.
Soriana swallowed hard.
The average Black Hat signed on to rough up neighbourhood malcontents, not to embroil themselves in dangerous guerrilla warfare.
Or, Mikkel continued, you can tell me what I want, and I'll make sure your pockets are filled with gold. We'll give you a job, or put you on the next ship to the Nine, or give you a whole slew of other options.
Mikkel removed his pocket watch and looked at the hands.
I'll give you 30 seconds to decide.
Soriana looked from Mikkel to Tenik to the guard. She licked her lips.
10 seconds left. Mikkel told her.
I'll be safe?
She asked.
Mikkel smiled kindly. I've eaten better since I switched sides than I ever did under the Black Hats. The brothels are better, the pay is better.
Not precisely true, but a good enough set of lies for the moment.
5 seconds.
He could see her waffling. He watched the last few seconds tick by, silently willing her to talk, then dropped his watch back into his pocket without bothering to hide his annoyance.
Sorry, Soriana. Take it away.
Wait!
She awkwardly surged to her feet, stumbling into the wall.
I'll take the offer, please.
Mikkel glanced at Tenik, who shrugged as if to say,
This is your game.
Yes. Just promise me that no one will find out I talked.
I think that can be arranged.
Where is Jertura? I don't know where Jertura is, but I can tell you about Mahush.
Go on.
He switched safe houses 2 nights ago. He moved to the house on King Street in Low Landfall. But you won't find him there. Not now. He's supposed to be meeting with someone important in an hour.
Tenik visibly perked up. Mikkel took a step closer to her.
Oh, Jertura.
I'm not sure.
I just know it's supposed to be in Claydon Park at 4 o'clock. He's been going to these meetings every other day for 2 weeks.
All right. Mikhail took a deep breath. This was the next link in the chain, but he'd have to move fast. Claydon Park was clear on the other side of the plateau. I'm going to find you later and get everything you know about the Black Hats. For now, we're going to make sure everyone downstairs thinks you've been executed. Give me your best scream.
The fastest route across the plateau turned out to be surrounded by a dozen Dainai soldiers on the backs of galloping horses. Mikhail clung to his saddle in terror as they rounded the western base of the plateau and then cut southeast. They arrived at Claydon Park with just minutes to spare, which Mikhail used to get his feet back under him before borrowing a looking-glass from one of the soldiers and scouting out the north end of the park. Claydon was a bit of marshland that had, at one point, been part of a Brudanian lady's estate. Early on in her life she'd filled in the marsh and had planted it with willows and beech as a garden for her sickly husband. Their great-grandson had bequeathed the land to the public, along with a generous endowment for policing and upkeep. Rumours had swirled for years that local industrialists were leaning on Lindet to develop it, and Mikhail wondered what would happen to the land under Dainai's rule. For now, it was still a park about the size of 6 city blocks. Traffic passed through a narrow road running down the middle, and a few squatters' tents had popped up in the overgrown lawns. Mikhail swept the looking-glass back and forth until he saw a middle-aged man sitting on one of the benches, surreptitiously reading a newspaper.
"Heads down," he told the soldiers. "You need to look like you're just passing by, and not like you're waiting for something. Do a circuit around the park, then head down that street there."
He pointed to a street leading to the industrial quarter. "And post somewhere at the corner to wait for my signal." Mikhail split from the group, Tenik in tow, and headed in the opposite direction around the park.
"Mahoosh is waiting on the bench there. Don't look," Mikhail told Tenik. "Whoever he's meeting hasn't arrived yet, and will probably wait for your soldiers to go before they approach."
Mikhail kept walking at a leisurely stroll. After he reached the midpoint, he stopped behind a tree and kicked at a rock, hands in his pockets like any loitering palo on a hot afternoon.
"Flip your coin," he told Tenik.
They had to wait only a few moments before a figure approached Mahoosh, sitting down on the bench next to him. Mikhail watched out of the corner of his eye for a moment, then moved a few dozen yards down the road to get a profile look of Mahoosh's contact. He slid the soldier's looking-glass from his sleeve and held it up to his eye. He blinked, rubbed the lens, and looked again. Without a word, he handed the glass to Tenik. The figure sitting next to Mahoosh was one who had burned herself into Mikhail's memory a week earlier. She had a soft face and medium-length red hair, and she lounged with a casual ease next to Mahoosh. She was dressed like a palo in a low-quality brown cotton suit. It was, without a doubt, Devon Fogula.
"Why is she meeting with a silver rose?" Mikhail whispered. "I have no idea." "Do we bring her in?" Mikhail asked.
Tenik lingered with the looking-glass to his eye for an uncomfortably long time before finally lowering it. His face looked like he'd just eaten an unripe lime.
"You're certain that this Mahoosh is still a loyal Black Hat?"
"Mostly certain," Mikhail replied.
"Mostly?"
Tenik chewed on the word. After a few moments he said,
"No. She is one of Sediel's, and if we make accusations, we must be prepared to back them up. We take this to Yarit as soon as he can see us."
Chapter 20
Stike, Carpole and Celine arrived in a tiny town called Grenalia a few days after leaving Tenny Wilds. Grenalia was nestled between two forested hills in eastern Fatrasta, and though it was a long way from landfall, it appeared to be abandoned as they came over the hill and rode down the main street.
"Carpole is going to teach me her sign language," Celine told Stike proudly.
"Oh?"
"Yeah. That way she won't have to write everything down. I can translate for her."
"And when did you decide that?"
"This morning, when you were taking a piss."
Stike rolled his eyes. It would, he admitted, be useful to have a translator. Celine was a quick girl. She already knew Adran, plus a lot of Palo and Kez, and a smattering of half a dozen other languages. He had little doubt she would be able to pick up a sign language in no time. As they drew closer, Stike was surprised to find signs of violence. Doors hanging from broken hinges, smashed locks. He dismounted to examine a few of the buildings, only to find the inside of the pub a mess of broken bottles. The general store was cleared of anything useful, as were all the houses and shops. He found a half-eaten meal on more than one table, and sniffed at the fly-covered contents. Whatever had happened here was recent.
"They haven't been gone for more than a couple of days,"
Stike said, as Celine followed him into one of the houses. She frowned at the contents of the table.
"I don't like this town. Gives me the creeps."
"It's just empty," Stike told her. "Nothing here is going to hurt you."
"I didn't say anything would hurt me,"
Celine replied defiantly.
"I just said it gives me the creeps."
She rubbed her arms, looking around, and followed closely when Stike went back outside.
"How long do we have to stay?"
"Until the Mad Lancers catch up. They should be here today, tomorrow at the latest."
"What if they already passed?"
"I'd see signs of 1,000 cavalry having passed through town."
Stike returned to Amrek and rubbed his nose. He wouldn't admit it, but the empty town had unsettled him. They were far from landfall, much closer to Little Starland, and if the Dianais were raiding all the way up here, it meant that Jackal's spirits were right about the fall of the other big coastal cities. If things were serious enough, it might spell trouble for the Mad Lancers. He turned his attention to Carpole, who squatted in the dirt road, running her fingers through the ruts from a wagon wheel.
"Any idea what happened here?"
he asked. She shook her head.
"The Dianais obviously took the people who lived here," Stike said. "But we haven't seen any evidence of that anywhere else. Why take these people?"
Only silence answered his question. Carpole touched her fingers to the spot on the ground and crossed over to Stike, showing him the gooey blackness on her fingertips. Blood, a couple days old. She seemed to feel at the air with those two fingers, then led them around the back of the church to a small, fenced-off graveyard, where someone had neatly stacked half a dozen bodies like firewood. The smell hit them as soon as they rounded the building, and Stike was surprised he hadn't caught it earlier. The corpses stank of shit and death, coated in flies as thick as molasses. Piling them unburied in a graveyard seemed like someone's idea of a twisted joke. Stike appreciated that kind of humour. Carpole wiped the old blood off her hands on the grass, then cleaned her fingers with a handkerchief and pulled out her chalkboard. "They did not resist," she wrote. That was Stike's first impression as well. He stepped over the graveyard fence to get a closer look, and was surprised when Celine followed him. Maybe the place genuinely did spook her. Bodies, on the other hand, were something she'd grown used to. He squatted beside the pile, running his eyes over them. If this had been a normal raid, or a looting gone bad, the bodies would have been left where they'd fallen, not stacked here in a bizarrely orderly fashion. These men and women had been executed, some with musket blasts to the back of the head, and others bayoneted to death. They hadn't fought back. It had to be the Dionys. But this town was much bigger than six people. Why lead off the rest, but not these? Carpole joined him, writing something on her slate.
This is a Palo town.
So? Stike asked. She pointed at the corpses, forcing him to look once more. Slowly it dawned on him. The dead were all Crescians.
So they killed the Crescians, but led away the Palo.
Carpole nodded.
Why?
She shook her head. A few moments passed, and she headed off on her own, poking around in the grass and walking into one of the nearby houses, no doubt looking for clues as to the fate of the town. Stike remained with the bodies for a moment, studying them thoughtfully, then did a circuit of the church. He wandered through several more buildings in a half-hearted bid to discover a survivor, before finally giving up and returning to the front stoop of the general store, with an overlooked bottle of gin and a fresh horngum root from the apothecary's garden at the end of the street. He broke off a piece of horngum and chewed it thoughtfully, feeling the numbness spread through his jaw. After a swig of gin, the numbness spread to his back, hips, and ass, to happily relieve so many weeks of riding tension. He leaned back on the stoop and offered the gin to Celine. She took a sniff of the bottle, shaking her head. The silence was interrupted by the sound of hooves in the distance. He listened to them approach, waiting for the shout of one of Ibana's scouts. But there was no shout, and the hoofbeats grew louder. He frowned, looking over at Celine. The sound was coming from the east. Unless Ibana had found a shorter route, she should be coming from the north.
What kind of horse is that?
He asked Celine. She tilted her head to listen.
It's light, she said. Maybe an Angland racer?
It's not an Angland.
Stike got to his feet. The road from the east was on the other side of the church. The problem that unsettled him was that he did not recognize that hoofbeat. Not entirely. It sounded like... He rounded the church to spot a small group coming toward him on Dionysian mounts. There were six of them, four men and two women, wearing regular Fatrastan travelling clothes and not outwardly armed. They had the red hair and freckles, but their horses precluded them from being Palo. Stike felt the hair on the back of his head stand on end as they came to a stop on the other side of the graveyard, barely sparing a glance for the pile of corpses.
"Who are they?"
Celine asked.
"Go back to the horses," Stike said. "Find Carpole. Both of you go to the edge of town and wait for me."
"What do you..."
"Now!"
Celine set off at a run. One of the horsemen broke off from the others and began to trot after her. Stike put himself in the man's path. That seemed to be enough, as the rider simply switched his attention from Celine to Stike. All of the riders were staring at him.
"Are you Ben Stike?"
one of them asked in heavily accented Adran. The woman speaking had a scar across her left eye. Whatever had caused it had barely missed leaving her half-blind.
"Who wants to know?"
Stike slowly reached for his knife. The man whose horse Stike had blocked pointed at Stike's chest. He spoke in Dionys, but it was close enough to Palo that Stike could understand most of it.
"Look at his size. He's a crippled giant with gunshot wounds. Has to be him.
Gee, Orts, go keep watch,"
the woman with the scar said. One of the men broke off and headed back the way they'd come, remaining on horseback on a nearby hillock.
"You are the man they call Ben Stike, correct?"
she asked. Stike's feelings about these Dionys grew worse and worse. He took a half step back. The group was far too at ease to be soldiers. Stike could see the bulge of knives beneath their coats, but none of them carried a firearm. He tried to remember the Dionys' title, Ji, but he didn't think he'd ever heard it before.
I am.
The nearest one leaned over in his saddle, peering at Stike.
You think it was just a story? I can't imagine an old cripple like him killing Ji Kushel.
Stike's blood ran cold as he remembered the name. Kushel. The dragon man he'd killed in Lady Flint's muster yard. Ji was the title for dragon man. He felt a small bead of sweat break out on the back of his neck and wrapped his fingers around the hilt of his knife. Six dragon men. Stike nearly died fighting one.
We were sent by Carsedil, the woman said, to kill the man who murdered one of our brothers in single combat. You killed Ji Kushel?
Stike had the sinking feeling that he was about to die. He fought the feeling, flinging it from his mind with a growing annoyance.
Six dragon men?
Whoever this Carsedil was, he had no intention of underestimating Stike.
Yeah, he said. I killed him. I popped his head like a zit.
One of the other dragon men snorted in derision. They glanced from one to the other, barely suppressing smirks. They didn't seem all that worried that Stike had murdered one of their comrades.
Ji Matl, the woman said. Go secure that girl.
Ji Matl flipped his reins, urging his mount forward into a casual trot that belied any kind of urgency. He came abreast of Stike and looked down at him, shaking his head.
I still don't believe it.
Stike stepped sidelong in front of the horse, jerking his head back from Ji Matl's quickly drawn blade, and rammed his boss knife through the neck and up into the brain of the horse. It spasmed, and blood fountained from the wound to cover Stike's arms. He shoved, pushing the dying creature over as Ji Matl leapt free with startling dexterity. The dragon man landed in a crouch, looking at his horse in dismay.
You're strong, he noted, looking over his shoulder at his companions.
Finish him quickly, the woman said, and we can be back in Dionys by the end of the month. You really think they're going to let us go home with a war on? Ji Matl asked. We have Carsedil's word. Would you question that?
Of course not.
Despite Stike's display of strength, none of the dragon men seemed at all concerned about the danger. While they spoke, Stike circled around to the horse and knelt by it, sawing at the neck with his blade, as if to make sure the creature was dead. The warmth of its blood felt slick between his fingers, and he whispered an apology.
"Come now, Ben Stike. You've already killed my horse," Ji Matl said, gesturing with a bone knife.
"I've got a knife like that," Stike said, still kneeling by the horse. "It belonged to your friend, Kushel."
The woman's eyes narrowed. Ji Matl looked to her once again as if for guidance.
"Where is that knife?" she asked.
"Left it with a friend on the other side of the country," Stike lied. "I just want you to know that I used it to cut out Kushel's tongue and eyes before he died. Then I took a shit in his mouth."
The woman spat.
"These Crescians are all damned savages. Kill him, Ji Matl, and we will be gone."
Ji Matl frowned, appraising Stike for several seconds before darting forward and drawing a second knife. Stike caught sight of the dragonskin armor beneath his duster, just as Ji Matl leapt over the dead horse, swinging his knife downward. Stike whipped his left hand out of the horse's neck, flinging warm blood into Ji Matl's eyes and then rolling out of the way of the swipe. He came out of his roll and reversed directions as Ji Matl barely managed to stick his landing and stumbled toward the graves. He dropped one of his knives, pawing at his eyes. Syke ran at him on the balls of his feet, Boz knife forward. Shemattel swiped blindly, slashing through the left arm of Stike's jacket, the blade biting into his skin. Stike did not slow, ramming his own knife into Shemattel's groin and ploughing him over. Shemattel continued to struggle, despite the life flowing out of him, reversing the grip on his knife and swinging for Stike's side. Stike caught him by the wrist and slammed Shemattel's elbow against the marble gravestone, bone erupting from the skin. Shemattel refused to scream, still attempting to fight, until Stike grabbed him by the face and smashed his head against the same stone.
The fight was over in seconds.
Stike dropped the crumpled figure at his feet, fingers covered with blood, brain, and bits of skull. It seemed like his whole body was slick with warm blood, from the horse and from Shemattel, and he turned to face the dragon man. They stared at him as if in disbelief, looking at him and at the corpse of their dead companion. The woman spoke.
"Cas Sedil was right not to underestimate you, Ben Stike," she said quietly. "Kill him."
The word had barely left her mouth when a blast went off nearby, and the top of her head exploded. Her mouth remained open, her face fixed in an expression of mild annoyance, before she toppled off her mount and to the ground. Both Stike and the remaining dragon men looked for the source of the blast, only to see Celine sitting astride Amrek less than 20 yards away, partially hidden by a nearby house. She held Stike's carbine in both of her hands. She trembled, visibly, and immediately began to reload the carbine. Several things happened at once. First, the dragonmen began to move, one towards Celine and two towards Stike. Celine dropped the carbine, and Stike began to run toward her, shouting over his shoulder,
"Karpol! If you've done hiding, I could use some of that blood magic!"
The nearest dragonman froze.
"What did he say? What name did you speak?"
The dragonman, keeping watch from nearby, shouted, taking the attention of all three of his remaining companions. They suddenly turned their horses and beat a fast retreat toward the east, leaving Stike standing in bloody clothes to try and figure out what had scared them off. He didn't have to wait long. The sound of approaching riders came swiftly, and soon behind them, the mad lancers rode out of the forest to the north, with Ibana and Jackal at their front. Ibana joined Stike quickly, staring at his clothes and the bodies of the dragon men.
"What's happened? Do you want us to run them down?"
"Not a great idea," Stike said.
The lancers might have a better chance against dragon men with carbines at a distance, but he did not want them to get tied up in a forest against those bastards.
"Keep everyone tight, and triple the scout patrols."
"Who the pit were they?" Ibana asked. "And what happened to you?"
Stike hurried towards Celine, calling over his shoulder.
"They're dragon men, and they've been following us since landfall. Apparently they've been sent to kill me."
He reached Amrek and picked up his carbine, returning it to the saddle. Celine looked distant and frightened. He pulled her down, taking her in his arms.
"It's all right,"
he told her.
"I killed her."
"You did. It was a very good thing."
Celine blinked at the sky.
"I didn't like it."
Stike squeezed her gently and set her on her feet, only then realizing that she was now also covered in blood. He lifted her chin with one finger, laying his other hand on her shoulder.
"It's okay. You never have to kill anyone when I'm around. Never again."
"But she would have killed you."
Her face hardened.
"I didn't like it, but I won't let anyone kill you, Ben."
"No, no,"
Stike said gently. She looked down at his arm.
"You're bleeding."
"That's just horse blood.
And human.
But it's his."
She poked him, sending a jolt of pain up that arm.
It's also yours.
Right, I'll get cleaned up in the river. Go find Sun and Teal. Tell her you killed a dragon man. She'll be very proud.
He pushed her away and headed back to the bodies, only to find Carpole had beaten him there. She frowned down at the dragon men's corpses.
He said, "If they'd rushed me, could you have done anything?"
She shook her head.
That's not very reassuring.
He paced from one end of the graveyard to the other, walking off the adrenaline rush. Part of him knew that he very easily could have died. Another part rejoiced at fighting another real warrior like that. The fight with Kushal had been drawn out. This had been short, brutal, and satisfying.
"Did you find out anything about the town?"
he asked Carpole. She shook her head. Frustrated, Stike paced the graveyard again. Maybe he should have sent the lancers after those dragon men. Losing even 100 men would be worth not having 4 dragon men prowling the countryside. He thought about the woman Celine had shot and turned to Carpole.
"Car is the title for the Bone Eyes, right?"
"Of the royal family," she wrote on her slate.
The implication was not lost on him.
"So, what are you? Some kind of princess?"
Another headshake.
"Then what?"
"I don't know," she wrote.
Stike stared at her for several long seconds, hoping she'd give at least some sort of elaboration. When none was forthcoming, he finally turned away to examine the passing column of lancers. None of them looked worse for wear, which meant they hadn't run into any trouble the last week. But that, he was certain, was about to change.
Chapter 21 Flora, Taniel, and Little Flaring relocated to a small complex of cabins deep in the forest on a gently sloped hillside. Flaring pointed at each of the buildings as they passed, explaining their uses. Most of the buildings were used for the creation and storage of black powder, but a few stone huts way up the hillside, away from all the others, were set aside for the substance that had made the Flaring family a household name throughout the Nine. Blasting oil.
"We do everything explosive," she explained to Taniel as they headed up a path to a cabin sheltered from all the others by a large boulder. "Black powder was our original trade, and still makes up the volume of our production. You'd be surprised at how many different mixes there are for mining applications. Explosive velocity, temperature, humidity, all these things have to be taken into account when we decide the formula and granule size."
"Just like mixing powder for military use," Taniel said.
"But far more complex," Flaring declared. "Out here in the mountains, you gotta be more careful. I'm handing explosives over to idiots from all over the world. Most of whom have never even fired a gun, let alone drilled into solid rock and detonated explosives in the hole. I got to know what kind of rock it is, the altitude, the depths of the mine."
She scoffed.
"I do everything I can to make it simple for the miners, but people still die every day."
"Is that why you're here?" Flora said. "I'm surprised you're on site rather than one of your people."
Flaring made a sound in the back of her throat.
"I'm on site because I'm making a damn fortune selling these miners blasting oil. Transportation has been banned all over the Nine due to accidents, so the damn stuff has to be mixed in person. I wanted to do a little travelling anyway, so..."
She shrugged and unlocked the cabin, ushering them inside. It was cozy without being cramped, with space enough for perhaps a dozen people to gather around a pot-bellied stove, or half that many to enjoy a game of cards. Flaring stoked the fire and put a kettle on,
then kicked her boots off.
So, that's why I'm here. You gonna tell me what a dead war hero and a decorated Adran general are doing in the armpit of Hatrasta?
Flora had been struggling with how much to actually tell Flering. She was perfectly trustworthy. After all, someone in the explosives business has to know how to keep secrets, to keep a leg up on her competitors. But this wasn't the kind of information she wanted spread around. Daniel gestured toward Flora as if to say,
"She's your friend."
"We're looking for an artifact," Flora said. "You've heard about the war."
"Everyone has," Flering replied. "Word just arrived the other day that landfall fell. We're so far off the beaten path that no one here wants to abandon their claim. But if the fighting swerves this way, my bags are packed."
"Right, well, we're looking for an artifact, an ancient bit of Dionysus sorcery that should be floating around nearby."
"Is floating around nearby," Daniel corrected.
Flora went on, "This artifact is the reason the Dionysus are invading. It has both Lindet and the Dionysus scrambling to find it."
"And you want to get to it first?"
Flora glanced at Daniel, whose expression was unreadable.
"We want to destroy it," she said.
"Ha!"
Flering moved a few bits around on the table next to her, until she found a boning knife and began to pick her teeth with it.
"What does it do?"
"It grants power," Daniel said quickly. "Sorcerer's power. The kind we don't want anyone to get their hands on."
"So you're here to find it and blow it up?"
"Maybe," Flora said hesitantly. "We have to find it, but we might have to figure out how to steal it. We tried blowing up a matching artifact outside of landfall with enough black powder to level a city, and it didn't do shit." Flering snorted.
"You military types think you know how to blow things up properly."
"I'd like to see you do better," Daniel said.
Flering sat forward as if intrigued.
"I'm guessing by your presence that this is a matter of the Adran Cabal."
"It is," Flora said.
"Well then, as a representative of the Adran government, and for a small consulting fee, I would be delighted to try."
Flora realized, without even knowing it, that she'd been hoping Flering would make the offer. The thought pleased her to no end. But there was a niggling feeling in the back of her head that not even Flering's blasting oil could damage the powerful sorceries protecting the Godstone.
"Consider yourself hired, but we still have to find the thing."
"Not sure if I can help with that," Flering said.
The kettle began to boil, and she got up and poured them each a cup of tea, then disappeared beneath the floor and returned a moment later with a handful of shaved ice, plunking a bit in each cup.
"I've been here a while. If someone had found a sorcerer's artifact, I think I would have heard about it by now."
"Perhaps," Daniel said. "It might be buried. It might be actively hidden. If you're willing to help us find it, we can do more than whatever the fee the Adran government will give you."
"Fascinating."
Flering continued to pick at her teeth with the knife, her face thoughtful.
"It's a bad time to ask questions, but I'll see what I can do."
"What is going on?" Flora asked, sipping her tea. "We got a little of it from the hotel manager. Some kind of power struggle?"
"Yeah, you could say that. Everyone wants the gold, but not everyone wants to work for it. Now, when we talk about gold sniffers in Yellow Creek, you got freelance fools digging their own holes or panning for gold in the streams, and you got hired fellas. The hired fellas work for one or two bosses, and those bosses own all the big claims in the surrounding hills."
She held up two fingers,
There's Jesse, the owner of the Pink Saloon. Her boys are called the Shovels. Then there's Brown Bear Bert. He's a palo out of Redstone who made a fortune selling family land to Lindy after his old tribe died to disease. Bert's hired fellas call themselves the Picks.
Flora leaned back, trying to take it all in, rubbing her eyes. Don't these guys know there's a war on?
You try to tell a desperate man he should abandon his claim to possible riches, and he'll gut you seven ways from sundown.
Flaring sighed.
Some of the independent miners are getting smolt, selling their claims or closing things off to wait out the war. But not Jesse and Bert. Those two are locked in a feud for control of the mines and won't let up till one of them is dead, or the Dinoes roll into town to claim the old lot.
We might be able to use this to our advantage, Daniel said thoughtfully. With all this chaos, we need to find the artifact and get out of here before Lindet even knows where we are.
Well, seems like a good call.
Flaring spat on the floor.
You know that bitch tried to kidnap me? Had some muscle up here 6 months ago trying to take me to landfall. Had to run him off with a couple of vials of blasting oil. Then make it clear to her that if she ever wants to do business with the Flaring Company, she will wait until I come to her.
I've met Lindet, Flora said. I can't imagine she took that well. Flaring spat again, then finished her tea.
I don't care how she took it. Brute force has no place in the business of explosives, no matter how incongruous that may seem. It's all careful, planned, and gentle.
She squinted toward the window, nodding to herself.
Sun's going down. I need to do me rounds afore dark, and you should get back to town.
She walked them to their horses and then said goodbye, before heading to one of the outbuildings. Flora and Tanya returned to their hotel just at dark and had dinner in the great room. The food was better than road rations, barely, with watered-down beer and unidentifiable meat. They spoke quietly about Flaring and their search for the stone. "I figure," Flora said as they finished eating, "we have 2 or 3 weeks until Olam gets here with the army. Those hills and narrow roads are going to slow them down, and I told him to take it easy. If luck is with us, we can find the stone and figure out a way to destroy or move it before they arrive. We sneak in a group of men, and we can be out of here without having to bring in the army." Daniel's eyes roamed the great room.
"Lots of armed men," he said. "If it comes to a fight, they won't stand a chance against the Riflejacks. But the last thing we need is locals seeing an army and digging in. They'll slow us down. We keep our heads down while we search. Don't let anyone know who we are. And we've got to stay out of this Picks and Shovels nonsense."
"You won't hear an argument from me," Flora said. Daniel put aside his plate and produced a leather satchel, flipping it open to reveal a sketchbook. Flora felt the corner of her mouth tug upward, and she found herself happy to see that Daniel still enjoyed his old hobby. She remembered posing with Beau and Tamas as a child, while Daniel, face serious, forced them all to sit still for hours while he perfected his charcoal drawings. She didn't pry, but a glimpse at the pages as he flipped them told her that he'd gotten much better since then.
"That," Daniel said, nodding across the room, "is a funny-looking man."
He opened to a fresh page and began to sketch. Flora would have loved to stay and watch him work, but she needed some time alone to think, and a full night's sleep would do her damn good. She fetched a bottle of wine from the barkeep and headed upstairs, gently tapping each door as she passed it until she reached the number that matched her room key. Rubbing her eyes, she stepped inside and closed the door behind her. She was surprised, when she blinked through her tired haze, to find the room already occupied. Three men waited in the